Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPATrendlines.com, now available on iTunes. CPA Trendlines presents an episode of The Disruptors.
Welcome to Accounting Disruptor Conversation. I'm your host, Liz Farr from CPA Trendlines. My guest today is Al Anderson, president and founder of Accountability Plus. How are you today, Al?
Just fine, Liz. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you again. And we've talked quite a bit.
Absolutely.
Over the years. Yeah. Now, we've got a lot to cover, so we're just going to jump right in.
Perfect.
Now, you've been working to change audit for decades. And you recently finished a book on this topic, which will be released in the near future by CPA Trendlines. And full disclosure, I worked very closely with Al on this project. What are the biggest problems that you see with audit today?
Well, you know, you can characterize the issues or challenges in our audit profession as problems, or you can recast them as opportunities. And I actually do believe that they're opportunities. They certainly are a problem if they're unattended to. And the real opportunity of auditing is the license you get to really take the time to understand your client and then how that translates to information on financial statements. The opportunity is we have the opportunity to check and have like keys to the kingdom to see everything that the client has as we try to understand their business. We're just not taking advantage of them. The other thing about our profession is that every company in across the land, small or large, has evolved tremendously as technologies continue to evolve. Our profession has been lagging behind in taking advantage of technologies and new ways of doing things in the audit process. And those represent a huge opportunity for us. And so what I've seen over my career is that we kind of nip at the fringes, if you will. We'll do a little bit here, a little bit there. We say we're basically leveraging technology. And then all we did was replicate the paper world. So these opportunities are sitting out there for firms that really want to move toward the future. And upon doing so, they will without question be seen as much more highly valuable in the eyes of the client that's receiving the audit.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it as an opportunity, because so many times audit is just a commodity and businesses can't really tell the difference between one company's audit and another. So it's just treated as a commodity. But what you're saying is that we can do a lot more with audit than we have been. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just a point on the commodity aspect is that I believe our profession has perpetuated the commodity side of it, because of the long and the short of it is standards continue to grow and accounting standards became more difficult to interpret and implement. The value proposition the client saw seemed to go down. So they questioned the fee, and we, as our profession, just automatically started reducing the fee, because we were the messenger. We had to help the client interpret these new standards, get them into play from an accounting standard perspective. And we didn't necessarily see the value either. So we basically saw, well, this accounting standard really is not all that helpful to the lender, but this Financial Accounting Standards Board wants it. And so we got to help the client implement it. The client doesn't see any value because they manage their business on a whole different set of metrics than GAAP financial statements. So we basically started to fall into the trap that it was a commodity as well. And so we started lowering our prices, ignoring the fact that we clearly have the opportunity to provide a lot more relevance to what we do by providing ideas and thoughts and suggestions to our client. Certainly not impairing our independence, but we can certainly offer suggestions. But at the end of the day, we helped perpetuate the commodity, and we can also turn that ship around if we want to. And that's why I go back to the earlier comment on these are opportunities if we choose to see them as such.
That's right. Now, your book starts out with four understandings that every auditor needs to master. Can you briefly explain what these four understandings are?
Well, yes. I mean, when you think about an audit of a historical financial statement, you see a set of numbers, right? And how can you interpret what those numbers mean, and even if they are fairly stated in all material respects, without, one, understanding your client? Do the numbers make sense relative to what my client is all about? Number two, understanding the industry in which the client operates. Do the relationships in those financial statements make sense based on what I understand about the industry in which my client operates, or the economic environment in which they're currently operating in, whether the times are highly inflationary, whether it's not inflation, or there's a downturn in the economy. The third thing is if you're going to issue an opinion on a set of financial statements, you need to understand the standards. Most firms use, you know, cookie cutter, off the shelf methodologies that have a lot of words that are repetitive in nature in many respects, but really don't help convey an understanding of the standards. They tell you what the standards say, but they don't translate it into an understanding. And so you need to understand the standards and what they mean in totality, not just in a particular tunnel vision. And then, of course, the fourth, and equally as important as the previous three, is an understanding of how to audit. We have not changed the way we audit a set of financial statements or accounts receivable in 30 years. We still send confirmations. There's a whole new audit evidence standard out there that provides more opportunity to think about things differently, but we still audit the same way. We're not thinking about new ways to audit to gain and gather the appropriate evidence from which to allow us to render an appropriate opinion. So understanding the entity, the industry, the standards, and how to audit, those are four baseline foundational things that all auditors need to have in their hip pocket.
I agree with you completely. You know, that certainly was not stressed to me in my brief experience in auditing. It was more, well, here's last year's work papers and just follow what they did. I certainly wasn't encouraged to go any deeper than that. And now you mentioned this new standard for alternate sources of evidence. What kind of freedom, what kind of opportunities does that give auditors today?
Well, you know, that standard, in my view, is basically a clarification of everything that was already sort of bound in the concepts of audit evidence to begin with. But it does provide clearer permission for the auditor to think of non-traditional ways of gathering evidence. You know, everybody talks about artificial intelligence. Everybody talks about data analytics. And most firms don't get past talking about it. They don't start thinking about what sort of data analytics would be very valuable to me to help me determine whether a set of numbers or a number or the financial statements make sense, and that I could render an unmodified opinion on those financial statements. And so the audit evidence standards basically gives you more guidance on what constitutes appropriate evidence, and even opens the door for using evidence within the accounting records and the systems and the subledgers at the client. You know, it was always sort of like, well, I can't just look at internal information. All right. Well, you can, because you have to think about whether it's reliable, whether it's complete and accurate. And then, of course, how much that internal information could be influenced by management bias. All right. And most transactional activity is really not impacted dramatically by management bias. It's usually the estimates, the things like the allowance for doubtful accounts, the obsolescence reserves, and things of that nature. That's where management can weigh in much more heavily on what they think those estimates ought to be. And so it does give you the latitude to look at things differently and move your audit to much more of a transaction focus than a balance focus.
That's a really important point. And I think that's a pretty interesting way to look at an audit, because I was taught to just tie out the balance sheet and then everything else falls to the bottom. But you're telling us that we need to look at the transactions and make sure that they're flowing through the system correctly, and that that can help guide us.
Well, you know, yes. And the reason that approach makes better sense is if you're going to actually be more valuable to your client in providing advice and suggestions, you're not going to be very valuable if all you do is tie out the AR subledger to the general ledger and send a handful of confirmations. But if you do look at how transactions flow through the subledgers and what it takes for the transaction to be reflected accurately, and then how that transaction then rolls up to the general ledger, you'll start seeing bumps in the road, and you'll start seeing opportunities where they could be more efficient and still strengthen controls, and they could do things better, and they're missing various opportunities. Maybe it's taking them too long to bill a receivable. For example, when you're doing receivables, at year end, and you get your receivable listing, you tie it out to general ledger, you have no idea that that invoice that was invoiced on X date probably could have been invoiced 5 days earlier, or 3 days earlier, 10 days earlier. Well, if you're delaying, if billing is being delayed by your workflow in your organization, you're missing out on 10 days of cash flow, right? Mm-hmm. What's more important to your client, cash flow, or that the receivable subledger ties to the general ledger? Well, in all reality, the client's interested in cash flow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I like the way that you bring that back to what is most important to the client. Now the bulk of your book describes a framework of five attributes of audit leadership that we need to move the audit into the future. The first of these is relevance. What does relevance mean in audit?
Well, relevance in audit is really that I am providing more than just a piece of paper that says the financial statements are fairly stated in all material respects. It's what am I gaining from understanding these numbers, how the client operate, how the industry is working, and I can basically give some ideas and suggestions. In other words, in my previous example of the receivables of taking that balance and sending some confirmations, or looking at the transaction flow, making sure things are getting recorded properly, and realizing that there's a delay in billing, what's relevant to the client? What's most relevant to the client is if there's a way they can improve their billing process to be more timely, to improve cash flow, that's relevant. And so it's really the value add, it's the insight piece of it. We are very focused in today's audit world on compliance, issuing the report. And we need to focus. We need to obviously achieve compliance with standard. There's no doubt about that. But we got, the client will rarely question our fees if we're actually giving them value, the relevance piece of it. That's what they want, is relevance. They think about your clients. Your clients expect you to have good, meaningful business conversations with them. They really don't care about the nuances of what the third paragraph on ASU 842 lease implementation says. What they want to know is, what does all of this mean to my business? And that's the relevance component.
That's really That's an interesting way to look at audit, because, you know, many of our listeners might push back and say, well, how can we provide advice? Because we're supposed to be objective. We can't possibly give them advice. That's going to impair our independence.
Well, I got a couple of thoughts on that. Is that the independence roadblock is the easiest thing for any practitioner to raise as an issue, because they don't want to change, right? No. They don't want to take the time to even understand the independent standards to really know what you can and cannot do. Mm-hmm. And so it's just an easy out for many practitioners to say, well, I can't do it. I'm not going to do it because it impairs independence. I'm sorry, that's a bunch of baloney. You cannot, you know, you can always make recommendations. You can always offer advice. You can always offer suggestions. And the client then can choose to react to your suggestions and your advice in any manner and fashion in which they want. And so they're still making the management decision. Advice is not making a management decision. Advice is just that. Advice, I'm giving you a suggestion. Why don't you try this? Or why don't you try a couple different ways of looking at this? You know, if the client says if your billing system is too slow and it's taking you 10 days to get a bill out the door, the client might say, well, what could I do differently? Well, the thing that auditing does is you get a chance to see hundreds of clients. Mm-hmm. And you might see ways other companies are much more effective at billing. And so you share your knowledge base with them and give them some advice, and they can do whatever they want. But advice does not impair independence.
That's very true. And that's something that, you know, you're right, that is a stumbling block for many auditors that keeps them from changing, because they don't want to put in the effort to try to understand what all of this means. They're just focused on getting the financials out without having to step back and think about what things mean and what these numbers, what the client's systems mean in the broad picture of how their business operates.
Days in the audit profession spend way too much time being busy as opposed to spending time being valuable. And so every firm right now is talking about the continuous 12-month busy season, all right? Uh-huh. And many of the firms out there have clients that they shouldn't have. They're terrible clients. They're purely commodity driven. They really don't care. They don't want to change. And we let them off the hook, and we do busy work on poor clients. When if we basically culled out the DNF clients and worked with the A, Bs, and Cs and got the Cs to move up to a B or an A, we would be much better off. And then we would be busy providing value and relevance and not just being busy.
That's right. Now, the next of these five attributes is business mindedness. And you split this into two aspects. There's an inward focus on your firm, and then there's an outward focus on your clients. Can you explain what you mean by this?
Yeah, actually, my previous example discussion about the DNF clients, that's the inward focus piece of business mindedness, is when you talk to staff accountants about why they leave a firm, oftentimes they leave a firm is because the firm has a lot of crappy clients that don't want to be a partner in the audit to help get the work done. In other words, and really don't see any value in it. So you're basically you're not really liking what you do. Then you go to a client who dislikes what you do even more. And so how can you be excited about what you do? So to be able to provide relevance, clients got to want relevance. And the larger the A's and B clients are the ones that benefit from relevance, are willing to pay for that relevance. And so business-mindedness means is get the right clients. The other thing about business-mindedness on an inward focus is you can't be all things to all people. I mean, just look at the statistics on employee benefit plan audits. You know, when you do five or fewer employee benefit plan audits, you know, your failure rate is like 70%. I can forget the exact statistic, but it's extremely high, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you can't, in today's complex world, you can't be a jack of all trades. You've got to be focused and specialized and build in your niche and basically be great at it. And when you're great at it in a niche, the clients will actually come to you because they know from their business network, when they talk to contemporaries in that same niche, they say, you gotta call ABC firm. They actually understand what we do for our business, and they are actually very valuable to us in addition to being able to do a very effective and efficient audit.
That's right.
The outward focus on business mindedness, on the other hand, is really thinking about how the client could run their business better. I started this process 20 years ago with young staff accountants. When we set up an audit, I said, okay, when you work in this audit, one thing I'm going to have you do is if you're working on receivables and sales, for example, I want you to go talk to the sales manager. And I want you to talk to the sales manager about the business. What does the company do well? What does the sales function of the company do well? What would you change in your sales function if you could? And what do you think the company could do differently and better? Just four questions, all right? And the whole purpose of that discussion was to get your staff out there talking to the client, not about why this amount does not agree with this amount that's listed on their schedule, because I'd rather have them know how that schedule came about, how the business was operating. And so you have to start building business acumen in the audit process by making it a natural part of their audit process. As you mentioned earlier, is in your career, you got last year's work papers. Well, we're teaching auditors an awful lot about how to copy. As long as I put the same work papers that are in there in last year's work papers and this year's work papers, the Sally approach, same as last year, I must have done an audit. Right? Mm-hmm. Business mindedness is getting out of the conference room. Business minded outward focus is getting out of the conference room, talking to people. It's getting from out behind the screen and actually talking to the people you're working with. Heck, I see staff accountants when they were out in the field, when they had a question of the accounts payable clerk, they'd send that accounts payable clerk at the client they were at an email and not even get out of the conference room and go talk to them. Huh. Auditing by walking around, especially in a manufacturer or distributor, and just seeing what that shop floor looks like and seeing how inventory moves is enlightening. Oh, that is when you start seeing the problems and you're talking to the client, and that's the business mindedness your client wants to hear. How can I run? What have you seen in your previous experiences with other clients that I ought to be doing to make my business better?
That's right. You know, and I know that when I did audit, I was never encouraged to talk to anybody besides maybe the controller or on rare occasions, maybe the CFO. But I never talked to anybody else in the company. Never. Never.
Yeah. That's unfortunate. Uh-huh. You learn a lot when you talk to people outside of accounting.
Yes, you do. You learn about how the business actually operates.
That's right. Absolutely.
Now, the third pillar is quality. And now, what does quality in your framework mean?
Well, quality is without question a standard by which we measure our profession against. There's no doubt about it. And we want to do quality work, right? Mm-hmm. But when you think of quality, there's a concept called inspection, and there's a concept called quality assurance. And what most firms do is inspect quality in at the end. In other words, they have some person, the QC person, who is the standards police person, where they basically rereads all this stuff and said you didn't comply with standards. All right. So it's all after the fact, and you're trying to get the engagement, the audit out the door, and you're running into these roadblocks with some quality issues. Quality, in my mindset, is an attitude. It's a mindset of the staff that I'm going to get it right the first time. I'm going to take the time I need to get it right, and not wait for the end of the line to catch it. And that quality assurance is a real time process. It's ongoing. It's concurrent as the engagement takes place. You're asking questions as you go, and the final review at the inspection process is then going to be purely perfunctory, because it'll be a final check, of course, but quality starts at the beginning and goes throughout the engagement and needs to be built into the fabric of what you do. And quality is not measured by the number of forms you fill out and checklists you complete. Quality is basically measured by how well you understand your client, back to those four understandings, how well you understand your client, the industry, the standards, and how to audit. If you have those four foundational pieces, you will be jumps ahead, steps ahead of your contemporaries in providing quality work at the end.
Absolutely. You know, I was certainly never encouraged to take the time to do it right. It was, let's get this out. And if it's materially close, then that's good enough. And we don't really care about whether the transactions make sense or not. Let's just make sure that they tie to the documents that we get from the client.
Yeah.
And that was really what we had to worry about. And whether, you know, we fulfilled at some level what the accounting standards said things had to be presented by. You know, that was about all.
Yep. That is for sure.
Yeah. Now, the fourth pillar is innovation. And innovation in your mind isn't just about bringing in the newest tech tool. What else does innovation mean?
Well, you know, let's start with this whole concept that most, as you said earlier, most people immediately correlate innovation with the newest piece of technology that's out there, right? Mm-hmm. Innovation is broader and deeper than that in the audit process, as it should be. It should be what mindset are we building in our people to think differently, to be innovative, to try things differently. In other words, how would you do this as opposed to same as last year? Innovation is just starting with a blank piece of paper and saying, I'm going to audit this client. Innovation is about the processes. It's people, process, and then systems. So innovating through your people, innovating through your audit processes. And then you will find the system, the technology, to kind of help you enable the people, your team, and the processes that you want to deploy to really carry it out as efficiently as possible. So innovation is everybody on board saying, I am going to look at doing things differently. It's talking about and being aware of what's happening in the business, being aware of what's happening in the industry in which your client operates and how the industry is changing and evolving. Just think about how the industry has industries have changed and evolved over the years. And then what are the success metrics that these industries use to measure what's going right or wrong in these clients? How often does an auditor even know what the key performance measures are at the client? And what the client measures for success. Well, if you know what the KPIs are, the key performance indicators, and you know what those measures of success are, then you start looking at innovative ways to leverage that in your audit process. And I don't have to use a new piece of technology. I mean, I can, they're the power of just a plain old spreadsheet today is so powerful in Excel that I might not even need to throw new technology at it, but I need to know what I want to accomplish and be willing to be wrong. One thing about innovation is every innovator idea is not always 100% right. How many times do people that are known for innovation start and try things, fail, learn, and start something else? So there is a concept of innovation that you got to build the concept that it's okay to fail.
Mm-hmm.
In my view, it's not okay to not try to innovate. Mm-hmm. It's okay to fail if you're trying to innovate and you recognize it and you move it forward. You're not going to do a bad audit, but why not build a culture of innovation in firms that the people are really given a chance to try things differently, that they're going to innovate with ideas, they're going to be attuned to what's happening in the marketplace. They're going to pay attention to what's happening in stuff like artificial intelligence. There's no doubt about it. Uh-huh. But artificial intelligence is one thing. How we're going to leverage in the audit is another thing. And that bridging that gap from AI to how to use in the audit is the innovation component that we all need to use. And that's people. That's not just pure old AI. That's people thinking it through. People understanding how to leverage it through the audit process. So it's people, process, and systems, all three of those working together with people and processes first before throwing a piece of technology at it. I have clients asking me all the time, what technology should I use for, you name it, a task, workflow, all right? And they say, well, what do you want to accomplish? You know, mm-hmm. most people throw technology at a problem without even really clearly defining what they want to accomplish. Innovation is saying, here's what we want to accomplish. And then what tools can I use to help facilitate that?
That's a really different point of view that most auditors have. You know, most of them by nature are conservative and they certainly don't want to rock the boat. You know, and I think that if I had suggested any innovative ways to accomplish the goals of the audit, the audit partner might have seen that as a direct threat to his authority. And I think that that's really sad that leadership was so afraid of innovation.
Well, you know, they all kind of grew up as this whole world has evolved. In other words, I'm so old. I started out when audits were not fixed fees, right? So it wasn't a big deal, and we placed a lot of emphasis throughout virtually all my career on trying to provide value. We tried not to fall to the commodity piece of the equation. And at the end of the day, we were always willing to try things different and change. Now, when you want to innovate in a firm, you basically don't say, all right, let's innovate and go at it and have fun. It is, you have to put a little bit of structure around it. And so, mm-hmm. because you could create chaos as well. So I like to innovate through what I call R&D audits, where we'll take an audit and throw out the standardized audit methodology in those programs and start from scratch. We'll do an R&D audit. We'll basically start from a blank piece of paper or blank screen, whatever you want to call it, and really craft an audit. Because medium-sized to smaller firms don't have the resources the largest firms have to have formalized, structured R&D groups, all right?
Right.
But every firm can have an R&D audit where they can go and say, let's just try something different, all right? And so that's the real key to this thing is innovation is a word in most firms' vocabulary. Innovation is not an action. step in most firms. Innovation can be an action step that can be managed at the pace you want to go as a firm. And you do that by building into the concept of R&D audits, where you'll do one or two. Most firms, I usually stop if they want to do any more than three. Then they're generally larger firms, but one for small to mid-sized firms, I say, well, I wouldn't do any more than one or two R&D audits in any given year and just work on them and just start thinking about ways of doing them differently. And it's an investment because there's going to be mistakes. There will, an R&D audit doesn't mean it's going to be 50% less time. It also doesn't mean it's going to be 50% more time. But you don't establish an expectation beyond we're going to try something different. We're still going to do a quality audit, but we're not going to be married to the same old thing.
And I think in listening to you, it occurs to me how important it is to have those four understandings really dialed in. Because you couldn't even begin to do an R&D audit, to do things completely differently, unless you really had a grip on those four understandings.
You know, it's interesting. That's an interesting point you raise, because I will tell you, when I work with firms on R&D audits, the first thing we do is we spend about a half day to a day talking about the client. Mm-hmm. In the industry in which they operate, the first two understandings, right? In every case, after we've done that discussion, the partner on the engagement would come up to me and say, I'm embarrassed about how little we know about our client. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. And just think about that is when you do this R&D audit, you drill down, start talking about the client, how they do things, what success looks like in the eyes of the client, and just going through all this stuff, and you, they don't know. And then they've issued audit opinions for all these years that the numbers are fairly stated. It's no wonder it's seen as a commodity and a purely compliance aspect versus a relevant part of what the company needs to move their business forward. And so it is a real eye opener. The every firm that's done an R&D audit has been so appreciative of what they learned from it, and they've done an awful lot of good things to kind of change the way they've done lots of parts of their audit sequencing because of those R&D audits.
That's fascinating, and I really wish that something like that had been more a part of the projects that I worked on, more the audits I worked on. Now, the last pillar in your system is empowerment. What do you mean by this, and why do you say at the end that this is the most crucial of the five?
Well, let's start with the current biggest issue facing our profession, and it's staffing, right? Mm-hmm. And think about those staff that have left. How empowered were they in their firm to do things differently? How empowered were they to think about, well, you know, I know the traditional workday is 8 to 5, but I'm going to do pieces of this at night. And so empowerment is really the culture of the firm that we have an esprit de corps to really, everybody has a key role in our firm, from the receptionist at the front of the office to the managing partner. And we're all empowered to help make this firm better. And we are all in it together. I'm not out for me. I'm not out for you. I'm out for let's make everybody successful. And empowerment is really an empowered culture is crucial. And power culture doesn't mean you do everything you want to do and without any question. It's called empowerment with accountability. In other words, we have some guidelines. In other words, you're empowered to do anything you want, but you still got to comply with honor standards, okay? Mm-hmm. All right. You're empowered to do this. And to think about this is that in today's world, the way we do audits, you know, because we're so married to same as last year, when I was starting in public accounting, the whole concept was, you know, 3 years in public accounting is worth, you know, 6 to 10 years in industry because you learn so much. Now, mm-hmm. 5 years in public accounting is not 5 years of auditing, is not 5 years of exponential growth in knowledge.
No.
It's 5 years repeated five times. It's 1 year repeated five times. You do the same thing for 5 years. You copy these work papers, you fill out this checklist, you move this forward, and so you repeat it five times. So the exponential growth of your knowledge base is actually hindered in the audit process by the way we do our audits today. And so you're not an empowered workforce to think about things different. And you can't be empowered if you've got shutters on, say, this is the work paper I want. This is how you fill it out. I want you to copy last year's work papers. An empowered workforce is the blinders are off and you're looking at the whole field of vision and you're asking questions and you're learning how to ask those questions. All right. And it's not the yes, no, closed end questions on a checklist in a methodology template. It is the open-ended question that you are focusing on as you're understanding your client's business and talking about what's happening in your organization. And then the skill in empowerment is then they become better at asking what I call the next best question. Oftentimes the staff will ask a question and they don't want the client really to answer it other than it's not a problem because then they're going to have to deal with it. But sometimes an answer to an open-ended question beckons a second question, and oftentimes we don't ask it because we're not prepared for that. An empowered group that understands those four pieces, the client, the industry, the standards, and how to audit, will now become much more adept at asking that second best question. Empowerment is creating the environment that it's okay to try things, it's okay to be wrong, and it's not okay to not comply with standards. In other words, so that is, you've got the opportunity to do things, but you still got to comply with the standards. Mm-hmm. All right? And we just don't give firms, the staff, the time to be empowered because we're busy being busy.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like empowerment would take a complete mindset shift for current leadership because they're, you know, we hear so much about, well, you know, if they're not in the office doing their work or if they're not in that conference room keeping busy, then how do I know they're actually doing work? How can I tell?
Well, that's a good example because I think the biggest bane to our existence in public accounting and auditing right now is the chargeable hour. I mean, everything today is pretty much fixed fee, so there is no chargeable hour per se. It's a cost accounting system. But more importantly, empowerment is not a measure of how many hours you work. Mm-hmm. Empowerment is a measure of what you get done. And so what we do with a lot of firms is we build what we call deliverables-based accountability. And I don't care, you know, if I sign you by Wednesday, if I want you to have a certain set of things completed by Wednesday, all right? And I believe that the level of effort that it should take you is reasonable in relation to my goal to have you be done on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So if you get done with those tasks by Tuesday, on a deliverables-based accountability, you've got a day free to go do something personal. And that just does not happen because we're so busy charging hours. And it's like chargeable hours. The hour does not directly generate revenue. I've got an engagement letter that basically tells me, here's what my fee is. And so I already know what the top line is, revenue for that client. Mm-hmm. I just have to manage my costs to make sure that my that there's a margin on it. This whole concept of fee realization is such a bogus concept because I get firms asking me all the time, what, you know, what's a good fee realization percentage? And I say 20%. And they say, I'm nuts. And I go, no, let's talk through about how ridiculous fee realization percentages are. Fee realization percentage is a function of your billing rate, right? So if my billing rate is $10,000 an hour, and I'm realizing 20% on that, that's a pretty good hourly rate if I believe in the charge hours. Now, if I said my fee realization was 120%, you're going to say, wow, how do you do that? That's wonderful. I said, easy. I have a $20 an hour billing rate. So fee realization is such a poor metric in our profession. It drives me nuts how people still hang their hat on that. We don't do anything, very few tasks, I should say, on a time and materials basis, all right? And frankly, I'm a big believer of the value billing concept and everything else. If I mean, I've got 30 years of experience, right? If it takes me 5 minutes to answer a question, it's not because it was an easy question. It could be because I've got 30 years of experience. So why would I just bill for 5 minutes and bill for the value? And so and I know I am providing at least the compliance component of an audit, even if I am not moving towards relevance, I know what the audit is what I'm going to charge. I know what the market is. I just have to manage my cost structure to get it done so I have a margin. And sure, there is time and effort there, but the hours are based, it should be a cost accounting system, not a revenue system. That's the big issue.
I agree with you. You know, and even when I was starting out in accounting, and we'd get in our mailboxes once a week this printout of a spreadsheet that showed all of our, you know, budget to actual hours and percent realization and percent productivity and all of that, I thought that that was just completely meaningless because it really didn't have any connection to the dollars that my efforts brought to the bottom line. And alongside those spreadsheets, about once a quarter, we would also get a printout that showed that, the dollars that my efforts brought to the bottom line. And that I found was a much more useful metric because I could look at that and see how that compared to my own compensation during the same period. And my rule of thumb was that I wanted to make sure it was about a 3-to-1 ratio. And when I was at that, when I was doing that, that meant that I was certainly being a good attribute to this firm. And that had absolutely nothing to do with my billable hour or how many hours I put in. There was a complete disconnect.
Yeah, it's really based on what you deliver because, you know, we tend to look at, you know, there's firms I've worked with where they say, well, so-and-so is moving up the ranks because, you know, they work a ton of hours, all right? And there's a firm I work with the guy that is the best auditor works the least amount of auditors, hours, but he actually gets more work done than anybody else. And so if you think about what that individual delivered versus time spent, there is actually generating, if not equal, more margin for the firm, depending on if what he or she does with that extra time because they're when they got their projects done. But oftentimes, those good people will take on more projects because they enjoy what they do. And and you'll find oftentimes that those reports that you referred to, and especially the chargeable hours reports, those actually work the exact opposite. They're demotivational versus motivational. They're demotivating because, you know, oftentimes if a first-year staff accountant, if they're behind budget by 100 hours, all right, how many of those 100 hours do they have the personal ability to fill by just taking on work? They need to be assigned to work. Now, they need to be proactive and say, I got time and all this other stuff. But so many of these reports are demotivational, that's why people are just leaving those reports, the bad clients, all these things. It all piles up to say, why am I'm not going to stay in public accounting. I'm not going to stay in auditing. This is no fun. You know, I tend to believe, I've always said this, and people, you know, kind of scoff at me at times. I say, you know, auditing is fun, but auditing the way you do it is not. And we just need to make it fun again, because that's when you really understand the business, the client, and the industry in which they operate. Again, back to those fundamental understandings.
That's right. And now we've already touched on this a little bit, but what are the benefits to a firm that weaves these four understandings and these five leadership attributes into the fabric of their firm? How is that good for them?
Well, I'll just take an example of a firm I worked with this last year. their staff retention was miserable, all right? And they're losing people all over the place. And we came in and we helped them throughout this whole process of understanding the entities and really building in the five pillars of relevance and everything else. Their staff retention went to 100%. Nobody left. The only one that left was one person they fired, and three people came back. All right.
Wow.
So it's a win for your staff and your retention. The firm's quality actually improved. They implemented all this and they passed their peer review with flying colors. And in previous peer reviews, they did not do so well. So people were happy, quality was happy. And guess what? The profitability of the firm went through the roof. And they did client satisfaction surveys, and their clients are even happier. So talk about a four-way win. Staff are happy, quality is better, firm profitability is better, and the client's happier. You can't beat that with all four of those improving just by thinking about marrying those understandings with those five pillars.
Absolutely. You know, and I wish that the firms that I had worked with had implemented even just one of these, but you know, like you can't implement just one in isolation. It's got to be all of them.
Well, that's right. And this is a continuous process. I mean, we have sort of mired our firms into a particular type of mindset and culture, and to turn it doesn't happen overnight. But what happens is when the staff sees the partners starting to turn it and starting seeing the benefits of it, they're saying, yeah, I'm liking this. I'm going to stick this out. And so this is when we work with firms, I say, you know, I'm not this person that throws a little bit of pixie dust and say, magically you're fixed. You know, we're helping them throughout, because it took a lot of years to get stuck in this mud. It's not going to get out of the mud and fully moving forward as overnight. And it does take a while, but if you don't start now, you'll never start turning the ship.
And it seems like a really crucial part of this change is buy-in from leadership. Do you have problems with leaders balking at these big changes?
Of course I do. I mean, we're not all cut from the same mold. And for whatever reason, in all of my career, from day one, I've been a change agent, driving change, loved auditing from day one. but I didn't love auditing by doing it the same way every year. I was always willing to try things differently. And I can tell in a 10-minute conversation with a leadership group of a firm whether they are willing to change, roadblocks to change. And some firms I've had to work with where I've had to kind of pull back the reins a little bit and slow them down a little bit. The change that they were trying to drive was creating chaos. And so it has to be a measured, not slow, but at a pace that makes sense so staff can see it. But there are firms, and it's just, and I just actually believe that the firms that are unwilling to change eventually are going to be history. You actually look at a lot of the mergers and acquisitions that firms are having today. The reason a lot of firms are selling to other firms is they didn't build a long-term sustainable model within their existing framework in their firm to build succession, to build future leaders, to build people that are going to move as the economy and as businesses change. They basically kept the firm the same forever and mm-hmm. realized that there's no one coming up the ranks that's going to be able to keep that, even the current state afloat long enough so I can get paid out as the retiring partner, so I'm going to sell. Lots of the reasons mm-hmm. firms are selling, not the only reasons, but a lot of compelling reasons firms are selling is they don't have built-in succession with them because they haven't positioned their firm to grow and move with the changing environment in which we're operating.
That's a really a very interesting observation, and it echoes what I've seen in following the firms that I used to work with. Now that I've been gone from public accounting for 5 mm-hmm. years,
sure.
and just seeing what has changed in some of those firms. So, in some of them, the names on the doors have changed a little bit, but overall, nothing really has changed. And I talked to somebody who said that even though he was pretty much bought out, his partnership interest was pretty much bought out, he was staying on because there just wasn't anybody coming up who could do the work.
Well, and, you know, we taught him how to fill out forms for years and just repeating the filling out the forms, and then all of a sudden they have to talk to a client and they don't know how to do it.
That's right. That's right. Now, I think that, I have a biased opinion, of course, but I think that anybody who wants to stay in auditing or is a little bit curious about it should get a copy of this book as soon as it comes out. I'm looking forward to getting this information into the hands of more people. Now, Al, if listeners want to connect with you, what is the best way to find you?
Well, I am more than happy to talk with anybody about this, and because I'm very passionate about it, because I really do want to see change. So I have a website, accountabilityplus.com. Also, you can feel free to email me, which is my first initial last name. So it's A. Anderson, AANDERSON, at accountabilityplus.com. And welcome anybody to reach out to me because it's something that I'm passionate about. I love to talk about. And I like to work with firms to help them succeed, because when I see staff members coming up to me saying, thank you for coming to our firm, that's what keeps me moving, because those are the people I'm working for is your staff to really starting enjoying what they're doing.
I think that's what it's all about. That's what it really should be about, is figuring out how to make auditing fun.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, I want to thank you so much for coming on, Al, and it's just been delightful talking to you. Again,
as always, Liz, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much. It was a wonderful conversation. I truly enjoy it.
All right. Well, thank you so much, and you have a great day.
Thanks, Liz. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPATrendlines.com, now available on iTunes. We hope you'll rate and review us wherever you find your podcasts to help other accountants find our show more easily. For more information, you can go to CPATrendlines.com.